The Guardian.
In the next phase of the coalition, both partners will be able to be clearer in their identities, but equally clear about the need to support government and government policy. We will stand together, but not so closely that we stand in each other's shadow.
Bruised in the local elections, battered on AV, now Nick Clegg vows to give his party a louder voice in government with Coalition 2.0. I'm Tom Clark and this is Politics Weekly. Amid the government's somewhat forlorn first birthday celebrations, we take a look at stroppy Lib Dems who wasted no time in showing off their new rebellious streak by defeating crucial parts of the government's policing bill in the Lords. Plus, after the pause, what next for the government's health policy and the future of the NHS? And with the killing of Osama bin Laden and the apparent stalemate in Libya, is it time to reassess Britain's military engagements? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's top columnists, Jackie Ashley and Julian Glover. A warm welcome to you both. And regular listeners, if there are any out there, will be particularly delighted that down the line from Westminster, we have Allegra Stratton.
Hi, I'm back.
Now, 1 year ago, Nick Clegg stood beside David Cameron in the sunshine and he promised that the coalition would last precisely...
because we are united by a common purpose for the job we want to do together in the next 5 years.
Spool forward a year, there were less shared values and more bragging about who was getting what.
In terms of policy impact, we are punching well above our weight. A recent analysis by the BBC estimated that 75% of our manifesto is being implemented through the coalition agreement, compared to 60% of the Conservative manifesto.
Jackie, the Liberal Democrats got their rude awakening, and it sounds there like Nick Clegg's smelt the coffee. I mean, he's doing the right thing, isn't he?
Well, except I have to say, I have to quibble with your introduction where you say he's already sort of imposed this defeat on the government in the Lords over the police bill, because actually the Lib Dem whips were urging their peers to vote for it. So that was not an early sign of independence. I think when we come to the NHS reforms, which is obviously the big trophy he wants to come away with as having changed, I think you'll find the Conservatives will not let him get away with it. The Conservatives halted this bill, paused this bill, mainly because of the opposition from the medical profession, not really because of the opposition from the Lib Dems. And Conservatives are only too keen to make this clear, that this is not the Lib Dems halting a wicked Tory reform. This is sensible Tories actually stopping it because they're listening to the concerns of both the public and the doctors and the nurses.
Julian, in a minute we'll come on to health, but first, can you just recap for listeners what happened in the Lords last night? And I mean, pick up on Jackie's point there, which is you might want a bit of mutiny, but once mutiny's started, it's fairly hard to organise.
And mutiny amongst peers is always greater, and mutiny amongst Lib Dem peers is the kind of ultra version of that. And the idea that peers can be whipped very easily is always slightly fallacious, and Labour found often, it too found its peers hard to control. I think the problem with the police bill is it is in the coalition agreement. It is a localist thing. It's the kind of thing that Lib Dems themselves get quite excited about, at least when they're not in power. So to suddenly retreat not just from a pilot scheme, which was the alternative that Nick Clegg appeared to want his peers to support, but actually to retreat entirely and just rip out elected police commissioners from the bill.
So we'd more or less stay as we are.
Except we won't, because it will be put back in. It's a thing that sounds very arcane, but it's actually the core of the Tory modernisation project was elected police commissioners. It's one of those ideas that Policy Exchange came up with many years ago. Cameron was involved in this. It's the sort of symbol of new Toryism. If they lose this, it really does begin to look like all of the sort of pre-election Tory modernist ideas are just slowly fading away. So they will want to come back and fight on this. And the Lib Dems have got to choose. Are they committed to this coalition in some form of shared values, which I think they are, and I think the coalition can only work if they are, in which case they do have to support some brave and radical things, perhaps not universally applying police commissioners at once, but putting out pilot schemes at least. Or are they just quite a conservative force tending to defend the kind of old instincts of the public sector when we've had police officers, senior police officers, criticising these schemes? Of course they would. It's changing the powers of the people who regulate them. Or doctors complaining about reforms again, deciding with the vested interest of the public sector. If that's what the Lib Dems are going to be, I don't think the coalition can really work over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I agree.
Jackie, I mean, the police are the one great unreformed service, and this was very clearly in the coalition agreement, exactly as Julian says. Isn't this a bizarre fight for the Lib Dem party, if not Nick Clegg himself, who didn't want it to pick?
Well, yes, it is. But I think Julian's right. It will be put back because I think the Lib Dems in the Commons aren't going to make a big song and dance about this. I think they will go with the whip in the Commons and it will get through. I think far more likely we're going to see, as the coalition goes on towards the autumn, I think that's the time when we're going to see actual real rebellions. And I think probably things like the health bill, I think there's bound to be trouble ahead on House of Lords reform. And I think once we get to the conference season, if the polls have not improved for Nick Clegg, I think we're going to have a real dilemma for Clegg and Alexander, who seem to me the only two desperately committed to this coalition. And almost everyone else is saying, both publicly and privately, they don't like it in much stronger
terms
than that.
That's simply untrue.
No, it's not.
They are not saying publicly that they don't like it.
Well, OK, we've had Paddy Ashdown, we've had Chris Huhne, we've had Tim Farron, we've had endless Lib Dems saying that they're not terribly happy and saying very rude things
about very happy is not the same as saying not liking coalition. I don't think it's at all true to say that most Lib Dems don't like coalition.
Well, where have you been over the last
Talking
2 weeks?
To Lib Dems,
given all, yes, and so too have I. Given all the stuff there's been over the AV campaign, there's been a huge degree of
animosity. Of course, there's unhappiness about the government. There's all sorts of unhappiness about the nature of things. There always is inside governments. I remember quite a lot in the last government. The idea that fundamentally then breaks the coalition is not true.
Let's bring in as a referee here Allegra, who does talk to lots of Lib Dem MPs down at Westminster. I mean, what's the mood?
Well, just particularly on the two thoughts that Jackie just raised. House of Lords reform is, of course, sort of related thematically to the rebellion in the Lords last night. These guys are quite rowdy. They are they regard themselves to be a check on the lower house, and the idea that the lower house can sort of impose a whip or a line on them is getting even more tricky. That will then become further tricky when, for the sake of showing what the Lib Dems have got from the coalition, there's a bid to push through House of Lords reform, which of course I think rather foolishly the Lib Dems have moved very quickly into turning into their next thing that they want, next big thing, because it's going to be so difficult when you've even got a third of Lib Dem peers not wanting House of Lords reform, people like David Steele who don't like it, let alone Tories, and then of course the Labour peers who are also unsure of it.
So there's the blessed crossbenchers who just wouldn't get elected, they're going to be against it, aren't
right.
they?
So there's a sort of management point there, which is why I'm surprised it's been set up to be the next big thing. The other thing that strikes me is that the Lib Dems have been listing what they got from coalition since January. So I think some of the sort of upset and the nature of Nick Clegg's speech yesterday, where he talked about being much more outspoken about what they've got, well, they've been doing that for 6 months. I'm not sure that necessarily shouting more and more about what you've got will necessarily achieve what you want, which is proving you're distinctive. Actually, the bigger concern for him is going to be how he actually, in terms of sort of goodwill and charm within the coalition behind the scenes, actually day to day getting stuff from Tories. You know, for instance, Theresa May will be so irritated that it's been defeated in the Lords last night, because she said in the Commons the other day, I think on Wednesday, there's no way this policy is changing. And as Julian says, it's a sort of big totemic thing for Tories. So I think there's a kind of there's a charm thing behind the scenes. It's all very well and good to go to The Guardian, to go on the Today programme, wherever, and be stroppy and say we want more. But actually behind the scenes, you've got to work with these people and you've got to get stuff. Some people would say, well, the Lib Dems should just call the Tories bluff. There's no way they're ever going to call an election. Well, actually, if you look at how well they did in the May elections, the Tories might be thinking, you know what, we could get an outright majority. That said, before the others leap down my throat, I think they'll... I don't think it is likely, but if it were to be likely, it would be after the boundary reviews, which happen on September the 10th. So I think
You're
September
totally
the
right,
10th.
You're totally right, Allegra. I think if there was an election soon, the Tories would win it, because at the moment, Ed Miliband has just two problems. One is he doesn't look experienced enough, and that's something that's only going to get better over the next few years. And he's also still got a residual kind of nastiness going on against him from the defeated Davidites, Blairites,
yeah, exactly.
Call them what you will. And that is going to get better over the next 4 years as well. Those wounds will heal. So in a way, it's only going to get better, I think, for Ed Miliband. And so the Tories really, I think, you know, may well think this is their best chance.
But come September, after the boundary review,
definitely, which favours the Conservatives, of course.
But Cameron would need a real excuse to go to the country. I think if he just said, oh, I didn't, you know, I did this coalition, but on second thoughts, didn't quite like it, and maybe we'll do OK, I think voters would... The nature of that campaign could turn quite heavily against him. Labour would have a very good case to say, you've promised us a five-year parliament, you tried to put this bill through.
It's going through right now, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that also faced a Lord's defeat. The need would be more than just, you didn't like my policy on elected police commissioners. Cameron would have to have some fundamental breach with the Lib Dems, and that would take the Lib Dems to almost trigger it and allow Cameron to say, well, I tried to work with these guys.
It would be quite easy to engineer one. You sack Vince Cable for disloyalty, that causes a bit of a crisis. You know, there's all sorts of things you could do to engineer a crisis.
Doesn't this bill, I mean, having proclaimed a new politics, having, and within a matter of weeks now, probably this bill going through, albeit with some fiddling around in the Lords, that fixes the parliamentary term, that significantly raises the political cost, does it not, of engineering an election? You then have to put up a kind of false no confidence vote, get your own backbenchers to go and vote for no confidence in you in order to force an election. It's,
you effectively have to have Labour to help as well.
Which they may do or may not.
Well, at the moment, I mean, I know it's far-fetched and all of this should be taken with a pinch of salt, but at the moment, that there are some people in Labour who say, well, if we had an election now, we could fight it on the NHS. And that would be quite... I mean, I take everything Jackie said about Ed Miliband's stock can only rise, but I think there are also ways in which you could see why it would work. Basically, it would work for the two big parties that would be needed to club together and say, right, we both think we could win this election, and then let's see, let's play chicken, let's go for it. And Tories and Labour, of course, the Lib Dems don't want it. No, it isn't. We don't know. And the thing about David Cameron is that he isn't predictable. He is quite a kind of bold... primary colours politician, and he could just, and also bear in mind George Osborne, and they could just say, you know what, we have to go for this is getting untenable. And it relates to the earlier point, which is, if it just becomes so fractious behind the scenes, it's all the time about things or just general attrition of policies from what they wanted them to be to what they're going to be, such that they actually think those policies may not work in 3 years' time or 4 years' time, there becomes a kind of, you know, what are we in this for question.
So we've got a kind of intriguing idea here of, a bit like in the AV campaign, you could have the two big parties ganging up on the Lib Dems and pushing for an early election. But it is, as you say, a kind of long shot possibility. So let's call the election fever just for a moment now and ask, we've just been discussing whether Theresa May could be the next Andrew Lansley. Let's just consider for a moment now the man himself. His plans were once again the focus of Prime Minister's questions yesterday. Here's Ed Miliband.
Let me remind him what he said just a month ago, Mr. Speaker. He said, I've been involved in designing these changes way back into opposition with Andrew Lansley. Can he therefore confirm that the failing NHS plans are not the Health Secretary's fault, they're his?
Yeah. A confirmation you won't be surprised that Mr Cameron failed to provide. But having pressed the pause button on his legislation to scrap the old structures and send a jolt of market forces through the service, the government is now having to fend off accusations that it's wobbling. Meanwhile, dire predictions are being made of Mr. Lansley himself. Allegra, do you get the feeling in Westminster, first, that this can be diffused with some sort of compromise, and second, that that compromise can indeed involve Andrew Lansley at all?
For Lansley to go, it would probably require some kind of reshuffle, which we know Cameron doesn't like doing. He didn't want to do one till, I think, March of next year, to sort of two parliamentary terms or sort of periods in. That said, so I would treat that with caution, the idea that he would go or be swapped for Jeremy Hunt or whoever, especially as there's a growing clamour for... The weird thing is that as soon as Clegg and Cameron seemed to distance themselves from Lansley, more and more Tory MPs thought, hold on a second, he's the hero of the backbenches.
And the whips were engineering this extraordinary show. Their 10 cabinet ministers turn up to an opposition day debate the other day just to sit there with him, didn't they?
Yeah, because there's a feeling... There's two things going on. One is a kind of just sort of normal personalities at the level of friendship, which is that Lansley used to be Cameron's boss. They used to work together in the political research unit for the Conservative Party way, way back. And so there's a kind of sort of residual deference going on, which is possibly sort of, this bloke was my boss, I can't possibly tell him off. Well, of course he sort of probably has told him off since, but that there was probably that kind of old deference going on. And that secondly, there's also a feeling that actually, and this has grown in tenor rather than diminished, it used to be that there were three letters that were important to David Cameron, the NHS, that's still true. He's pissed off that this has become a political issue when he tried so hard to completely detoxify it as an issue. But now there's a conversation growing about, well, actually, hold on a second, health inflation is now 7% rather than 4%. There is the possibility that you have runaway costs within the NHS, which make the headline pledge by Cameron of not touching it at all, ring fencing it, giving in real terms increase, but even more untenable. So there's a kind of sort of petulance coming from backbenchers and indeed ministers who feel, well, hold on a second, we're about to give this NHS reform up because it has been mishandled by Lansley. He didn't do the groundwork. If you look at IDS's department, if you look at Eric Pickle's department, like them or loathe them, but what they did with their humongous changes was they prepared the ground with a constant drip drip of stories about how bad the situation was and how it needed remedying in, you know, the our newspaper, Daily Mail, wherever. But by creating the kind of zeitgeist for change, they then were able to do it. Andrew Lansley didn't do any of that. That said, there is a growing feeling that that maybe the NHS does need reform despite David Cameron's opposition pledge.
Well, let's just focus on that for a minute, Julian. I mean, we remember the the infamous airbrush posters, I'll cut the deficit, not the NHS. The NHS was the one sacred cow in difficult times. We all knew that was going to be difficult to fulfil because having what they call real terms increase, which effectively means a freeze, is going to feel like cuts.
Particularly if inflation rises as it has.
As it has. And so isn't David Cameron's personal reputation very much at the risk of this? These reforms and all this row, he's sort of taken ownership of the spending squeeze in a way he hadn't done before.
He has a bit, and I think the difficulty was to give the impression he wasn't going to reform and then announce a lot of reforms, and then to make that worse by giving the impression he wasn't sure the reforms were very good. And then now, as Allegra has written very well in The Guardian today, quite a lot of Conservatives also think the reforms are good. I mean, there's a lot of others too, I mean, who say, just rid us of these dreadful things, it's just causing us trouble in the constituencies. I'm not sure what the political dividend is in the short term, and many of the things that
they're more tacticians rather than policy ones, aren't
quite,
they?
Yeah, quite. Of course they are. But they're politicians, so they're often like that. Yeah. And that many of these things, the good bits of it, can be done without a legislation. And that's one of the difficulties of reforming public services, is sometimes ministers want a big bill because it sounds exciting. You don't always need a big bill to do management changes. A lot of what happened to the NHS under Labour, massive increase in marketisation and private provision within the NHS, wasn't done through the House of Commons because Labour MPs would have kind of swooned had they known what was actually happening to the NHS. It all just took place quietly. And the same could happen again. It didn't need a bill. Having a bill, they then failed to provide the justification for it. And of course, what's also happened is lots of people have then begun to oppose the bill for things that were already happening or worry that the bill did things it wasn't supposed to do. Quite rightly, the NHS began to prepare for this legislation. It's now left in a terrible state with primary care trusts and others busy sacking people and moving staff and having no idea what the government's doing. It's really got to get a move on.
And this, Jackie, is exactly the point, isn't it? Most of the country likes the NHS, doesn't want to pay more tax, and it doesn't kind of go much more than that. They don't have strong views on the detail of this reform. But when you press the pause button on a revolution halfway through, primary care trusts have laid people off. There are many of them now being run by temps who don't know how long they're going to be doing it. I mean, it's a total recipe.
It is a complete chaos.
What should they do?
I've had the good luck not to have been in three different hospitals in the last couple of months, actually. And each time you talk to the professionals, well, you don't even need to say, I'm a journalist, tell me. The first thing they say, apart from, you know, lie down for your x-ray, is, I can't believe the mess the government's making of this. And I think what's happening is they are now in total chaos. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody knows if these reforms are going ahead, if they're half-baked going ahead, if they're not going ahead. And the point they all make is, you know, why did they not come and talk to us first? And I think this has been the huge error. I think Allegra's absolutely right. Lansley not only didn't prepare the ground, but didn't talk enough to the professionals first before embarking on this route and consider all the implications. And
it's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because he was chosen. Remember back in the day in opposition, Cameron made a big thing of, this is the one guy who I know, if I go into government, he's going to have, I know what job he's in. And it was partly, he was so sure
of
him.
He had years in opposition doing it.
Yeah, and it was partly because it was relationship with the professional.
I think this is one area of policy where the sort of charge for or against the coalition really stands, which is it has accelerated and enhanced the sort of nature of reform. Lansley came along with his set of changes. The Lib Dems and Paul Wurster arrived with their changes, and they sort of put them together, and the synergy between the two was like a sort of double change rather than either side holding the other one back. And so the Lib Dems said, well, we don't want primary care trusts, and they sort of crossed those off the Tory
list.
That's
fascinating. Really good point.
And so people who like the coalition might say, well, that's the coalition really working, you know, liberal ideas and Tory ideas going together to produce something more. The danger is it led to a policy that nobody before the election had expected. People could have coped with the old Tory plan or maybe coped with the Lib Dem one, but they never knew it was going to happen. The thing was to have both at once, and suddenly to lose all top-level planning above GPs, effectively, was not something that Lansley had planned before the election. He just sat down with the Lib Dems and they had a sort of eureka moment when they realised they agreed. And that was not consulted or discussed with professionals at all. And I totally understand, I mean, Jackie's right, why professionals are upset is they say, well, you didn't tell us.
Ask us. More to the point.
Well, a bit of both. You have to ask and tell.
Okay, we'll leave the health service there. You can read more if you want to on our NHS rolling blog, which I've been chained to for part of the week, and also at guardian.co.uk/society. The coalition may be 1 year old this week, but the war in Afghanistan turns 10 later in the year. The conflict started, of course, in 2001 after the horrors of 9/11 and survives the death of Osama bin Laden. And now it's going on in parallel with an operation in Libya. Julian, you've been in Afghanistan several times, but the bogeyman's now gone with the death of bin Laden. Is the case even fuzzier than it was as to why we're there?
Well, the case is probably quite fuzzy now. The deadline is clearer, and so the politics of it are shaped by what America is doing with its kind of surge and then the drawdown, which is now beginning, and the British sort of trailing along after that, effectively saying we're going to get out by, if the next election is 2015, we'll more or less be out by then. And so the military strategy is being shaped by those deadlines rather than the sort of political demands of what needs to be done in Afghanistan.
Which must be dreadful if you're a soldier, mustn't it?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, they I guess they might say they had some clarity. We had some excellent reporting in The Guardian this week from Nick Hopkins, our defence correspondent, who had military officers in Afghanistan almost pleading, you know, give us the chance to do the job. And they're very convincing about that. The difficulty is my very minimal experience of going to Afghanistan three times at different periods in the campaign is that each time you go into very impressive briefings with extremely impressive officers from American and British armies who say, well, it was all a terrible strategy last year, but we've really worked it out now and we're engaging with the local Afghans and cracking on and we just need a bit more time. Don't go wobbly. And I first heard somebody say that when I went with Nick Clegg, I think nearly 4 years ago. And every time they always say it was worse the year before, but now it's getting better. The evidence for that is pretty limited. I think the politics of it are just keep this war out of the news, leave it as forgotten as possible, and slowly pull out and hope nothing too bad happens in the short term afterwards. That's a very dishonourable thing to do for Afghanistan and a very dishonourable thing to do for the British military. One of the politicians who's been engaged at a better level than that is David Miliband. He's found it quite hard, of course, to speak in British politics now because of his relationship with his brother, but he in America gave a speech.
I think he's having a good go.
Yeah, he's having a go. I mean, even in America, he gave a speech recently trying to raise the issue of what he said was a forgotten war. One very final quick point is that the difficulty for the people like David Miliband is that their strategy is effectively talk to the Taliban. Other people, I think, quite reasonably say, well, A, why should the Taliban talk if we're going to go anyway? And B, who are the Taliban? And if we could talk to them, we would have done it anyway. It isn't, apart from Hillary Clinton, who is very opposed to doing so, it isn't that the Western powers have not wanted to stop this war and get out for quite some time. It's not easy to do a deal. I wonder whether the bin Laden thing is all a distraction, really. We're just looking for an excuse to leave, and if that gives us the excuse, then so be it. I don't think it makes any real difference.
Maybe of more relevance than the bin Laden thing is the Arab Spring and or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
But the idea, I mean, one of the things that David Miliband said in his speech was, A, you Americans, you need to get more politically involved rather than militarily involved. But that secondly, you needed to involve the region more and that possibly you needed to appoint a Muslim figure as a UN representative who was solely yes. responsible for taking Taliban, but also other sort of stakeholders out of Afghanistan and somewhere else and talking and then going back. But that requires other Arab countries, doesn't it? And they're quite busy at the moment.
David Miliband's target was ironically Hillary Clinton, the person he seems so close to in that lovely London.
You had a crush on him.
They used to have that great crush, but Hillary Clinton has been a peculiarly obstructionist figure in American political engagement, rather military engagement in Afghanistan.
I think we have to remember that, you know, when all this started, the Americans were almost looking for someone to blame for something to do, weren't they? And we went along on their coattails with them. And I think, you know, as always, the Americans call the shots and decide on what's happening. And I think, you know, Britain really needs to consider our position separately from the Americans, would that we ever did over things like Iraq and indeed Afghanistan. But I do think, as Julian says, it is fairly dishonourable to sort of pull out and leave goodness knows what kind of mess behind. And I'm hoping that there'll be a little bit more effort on the infrastructure, on civilian society, trying to build a proper structure there before we just leave chaos and no doubt sort of, you know, much more bloodshed for the people we left behind.
One of the things we need to do is to really take the lesson of the Soviet period in Afghanistan, and the model of the pullout that the Soviets engineered much more quickly than we did and much more effectively, and also created more infrastructure in their time, was you leave a government which has some credibility, and I don't know if Karzai is that government, but he's the best we've got. You prop up the cities, you try and keep the roads between cities open, you do leave some minimal military force supporting the Afghan National Army. You then don't try and fight in the villages of Helmand. You let the country become much more fragmented, but you don't let it totally implode, and you try and avoid a civil war between North and South. And I think that is achievable.
Allegra, just remembering as well that there's the other operation now in Libya, which a few weeks ago the House of Commons voted by something like 550 to 30 or something in favour of, or 13 was it even. But lots of the MPs who voted for it said that, you know, if they, a better representation of how the House felt would have been a sort of 60-40 split or something. I just wondered, as we're several weeks into that campaign now, are you picking up any nervousness about that?
I have to say not. Because I'm picking up nervous about NHS, you do have a sort of capacity problem on occasion with there's so many things that many people are exercised about. But sort of more substantially, Liam Fox made a speech recently suggesting that you know the West must be, or rather the UK or the international coalition. It's very confusing when they talk about this coalition, I think, of Lib Dems and Tories, but the international coalition of people who are involved,
voters would be confused between the two, I think.
The coalition that's involved in Libya has to be prepared for it being another type of Afghanistan, i.e. if we're going to do it, we've got to do it for the long haul. Liam Fox is on the right of the party, to say the least, and if he's acceptant that this is a long game, not a short game, then I think he'll take a lot of Tory backbenchers with him.
But Julian, I mean, there will be a lot of Tories who'll be very worried, won't there, about the fact that Liam Fox, who might be on the right, but he's very gung-ho.
There's a lot of Tories who are very worried about the fact of Liam Fox. more widely, it's really interesting. I mean, I was in the debate in the Commons at the start, and there are lots of Labour people who supported this and some who opposed it, and lots of Tories who supported it and some who opposed it. It was a very good debate, with people on all sides standing up and making some quite good speeches, questioning the strategy. The difficulty is that we both at the same time want a limited engagement, which I support, and a clean end to it all. And perhaps the reality is that there isn't a clean end. There's just going to be lots of messiness, and messiness might be less bad than some other form of messiness we might have had, you know, the victory of Gaddafi or the theoretical deaths of an awful lot of civilians at his hands. But that isn't the same as the government delivering a clear win. And, you know, Scoop, Evelyn Waugh's great book, as the foreign editor of the Daily Beast, saying we demand a clear battle between two tribes, we support one side, and we want a fully declared victory in which the Daily Beast can back the winning party. And we sort of wanted that in Libya. We wanted the rebels to march into Tripoli and, you know, have democratic elections and loveliness. It was never going to happen.
No.
And
I think, to be fair to Cameron, he didn't expect that, actually.
Exactly,
I mean, I think he wasn't going in saying, well, we're going to finish this quickly, cleanly and easily with a couple of airstrikes and it'll all be fine. I think he did know. And sort of, I think, you know, this is where he does have a very good tone, I think, when he announced it. He was saying this ain't necessarily going to be easy, and he's aware of all the difficulties, and this could be a long thing. And I think probably he still did the right thing, because he had to save all those civilians.
And so far, he hasn't done what many of the people in the Commons worried he would do, which is to sort of, week after week, increase the involvement, start sending troops in, getting a bit more. He's so far held back. Britain isn't doing very much. The RAF is, you know, poor things are doing their best with their sort of four planes that still fly and out of a sort of series of hotels in southern Italy. But generally, it is not Britain that's leading on this. It isn't something that's unsupportable for quite a while. It's just very embarrassing not to have a clear victory. It's not like Afghanistan or Iraq with a military land invasion.
Well, for better or worse, Libya might have a long way to run yet, but we don't. Our time is up. So my thanks to Jackie Ashley, Julian Glover and, of course, Allegra Stratton. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.